Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McGuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au, or on the podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's great to have your company here this morning. And I guess there seemed to be a lot of shock around, you know, internationally, that Donald Trump won the US presidency yesterday from Hillary Clinton, the favorite going into the election yesterday. I actually wasn't particularly shocked. And the reason for that is actually a man I've got sitting in the studio today, Joseph Boston, a writer who writes continually about, I guess, a whole host of issues. He actually called this election a year ago. And I think that's really awesome. So I had to get him on in this morning to explain a bit of his perspective. But first, I guess, he's been on the show before, but Joseph, welcome to the program. Would you like to explain a little bit about your background, very briefly, I guess?
Yeah, very briefly. Been out here in Brisbane. I live here in Brisbane, been here for about 6 years. Moved out here in 2010. Originally was born in the UK. My father's American. He was an American service member. Met my mom over there. My mom is Jamaican. Mm. Big up my Jamaican listeners if there's anybody out there. And so I've just traveled quite a bit, lived around the world due to my dad's military service. Been very blessed in that regard. And yeah, now I live here in Australia. I'm a social worker, writer, social critic. Yeah.
And a very good grasp of US history, which I think informs why you sort of anticipated this for a very long time. But I guess yesterday we saw a lot of analysis, very shallow analysis. Mm. There was one grab, and it was played in the news just before by a CNN commentator, Van Jones, and I wanted to play it today because I think definitely the thing that's been missing in this analysis has been the issue of race. So here's Van Jones.
There's another side to this. People have talked about a miracle. I'm hearing about a nightmare. It's hard to be a parent tonight for a lot of us. You tell your kids, don't be a bully. You tell your kids, don't be a bigot. You tell your kids, do your homework and be prepared. And then you have this outcome, and you have people putting children to bed tonight, and they're afraid of breakfast. They're afraid of, how do I explain this to my children? I have Muslim friends who are texting me tonight saying, should I leave the country? I have families of immigrants that are terrified tonight. This was many things. This was a rebellion against the elites. True, it was a complete reinvention of politics and polls. It's true. But it was also something else. We've talked about race. I mean, we've talked about everything but race tonight. We've talked about income. We've talked about class. We've talked about region. We haven't talked about race. This was a white lash. This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president in part. And that's the part where the pain comes. And Donald Trump has a responsibility tonight to come out and reassure people that he is going to be the president of all the people who he insulted and offended and brushed aside. Yeah, when you say, you know, you want to take your country back, you got a lot of people who feel that we're not represented well either. But we don't want to feel that someone has been elected by throwing away some of us to appeal more deeply to others.
So that was Van Jones on CNN. And Joseph, I mean, there's a whole heap of to unpack in that. But how would you, I guess, respond to that, particularly looking at, you know, the whitewashing of the campaign, I guess?
I mean, yeah, I would state that the Trump win was the White Lives Matter, right, response to the first black president who was committed to the maintenance of white supremacy and American imperialism and power, but whose very imagery and presence screamed only Black Lives Matter to white America, and white America felt very oppressed by that. And I think that's the most significant aspect of the election outcome.
Well, they overwhelmingly voted for Trump, and I think I guess people seem to be surprised for it, but it was an overwhelming great year when obviously white men,
yes,
but definitely white women, which I guess people didn't expect because gender's played such a big part in Hillary Clinton's campaign.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. I think, again, that speaks to a lot of people were going by polls that I thought that the polls were going to be off in this election, and it obviously was proven right. But white women traditionally vote Republican. That's the irony, right? I think that's why it's so surprising to me that people were surprised that white women so overwhelmingly voted for Hillary. I think the current ballots are still being counted, but the current data says like anywhere from 53% to 66% of white women voted for Trump. But that's historically consistent. There was a lot of different media reports leading up to the election about that, you know, what that vote was going to look like. And I was reading a number of those articles. And a lot of different discourse about how Trump wasn't doing as well with Republican voters or white women voters as previous Republican nominees had had. Like Mitt Romney, you know, overwhelmingly had a significant amount of, I think it was like 80%, maybe like something like that, could be wrong, of the white women vote when he ran in 2012 against Barack Obama. But yeah, even though he wasn't doing as well with white women, Trump was still, yeah, he still had their vote, right?
I mean, obviously, polling plays into expectations that people thought or wanted to think about the way people were voting.
Yeah, totally. I think that like polls are getting hit hard right now, right? People are like, polls are trash. Like, like we shouldn't use polls as any kind of indicator. I mean, nothing's a perfect science. I don't think you should ever judge anything just off of a poll. Polls are good or bad depending on what information we're drawing from and like what certain questions are asked. There's a lot of variables that go into polls that make polls effective or informative. I think in this election, though, because of the issue of race, that was one of the reasons why I said whatever the polling data says is going to be, doesn't matter, because this is one of the most, this was the most preeminent election of the 21st century.
Yeah.
I think in American history, it's a generationally defying election. It wasn't no regular election. This election was the first election after the first two-term Black president.
It's interesting you say that because it's funny how people are so quick after 8 years ago, historic, first African-American president.
Mm.
But now people are very quick to forget President Obama's Blackness, aren't they? And the effect it had on maybe electing Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, obviously white America didn't forget.
obviously not.
That's very clear from what we see in the results of this election. They didn't forget. It was at the forefront of their mind. And as we were talking previously before we started the interview today, I think it's the peak, as I said at the beginning of the interview, it's the peak White Lives Matter response. In the last year alone, we've been dealing with, you know, Black Lives Matter, and then immediately the response has been All Lives Matter. I think this really, coming towards the end of the year, this is a punctuation mark on that. No, white lives matter.
Yeah, and we see that because they're voting for their own interests, obviously. And the way the analysis is going is, I guess, more sympathetic to that, you know, own interests.
Yeah, totally voting to their own interests. I mean, I think that's why, to the degree, the way the white women voted is getting so much attention with so much controversy surrounding this very polarizing candidate, his misogyny, his sexist statements, the sexual assault charges against, I think he has a charge against him, the claims that women have made that he sexually assaulted them, all of those things so polarizing, I think that was part of the belief why white women were also not going to vote for him, because of those issues that were surrounding him, and yet they did.
I mean, right. That's confusing, isn't it, seems?
It isn't. I think that when you look at I think it's not really that surprising to me, though. Again, when you look at the suffragette movement, right? Like that was the women's struggle to attain the vote that they got in 1920. But a key aspect of that was their complicity to white supremacy, right? These leading figures, Elizabeth, I think her name's Elizabeth Canton, you got your Susan B. Anthony. One of the statements that she made was that she would rather cut off her arm than fight for the vote for the Negro. Right? Over a woman.
Yeah.
So core to the suffragette movement was making sure that white supremacist patriarchy was comfort Yeah. And these upstart women who wanted to have the vote, and white women went out of their way to let them know, hey, we don't want to disrupt what's in place. We don't want to disrupt white supremacy. We're not trying to bring an end to that. We just want accommodation into it.
Which is probably why they can't dismantle the patriarchy, because the two are tied,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yes, they're definitely tied, and we see that. Nobody can make an argument to the contrary, right? Especially after this vote. We see white women's commitment to white supremacy and white patriarchy by turning out for a candidate who only, what, a couple weeks, a month ago, white women were up in arms about his, can I say this on the radio? About his grabbing women in their their genitalia,
I think we all know that comment.
Yes, yeah, right, right. We were up in arms and yet went to the voting booths and voted for that candidate.
Yeah, voted for him.
Right, and voted for themselves at the detriment of all other women, black women indigenous women in particular. So I think, yeah, the question for me, and it should maybe be the question for many white women and in particular white feminists out there is, you know, after attaining the vote in 1920, at least in the United States, I don't know what that data is here, but yeah, after attaining the vote, what is, voting in the first white woman candidate isn't the chief or the main accomplishment of the white feminist movement, then what is white feminism going to do? What is the point?
But I think it's what you're telling me before about not wanting to do the work to make these historic things at the top. But you actually have to lay the groundwork. And obviously we're nowhere near towards actually dismantling that patriarchy, and yet we want to jump forward, I guess, a whole heap.
Yeah, I think, I'm surprised that people are surprised, right? That with the election outcome, is when the work was never done. And as you were saying, that I feel like there's a degree to which Barack's presidency in 2008 and 2012 was considered to be the work.
Yeah.
That
we were post-racial.
This notion about we're in the post-racial age of Obama, that this symbolic representation of the first black president, the first two-term black president, meant somehow that the work had been done.
Yeah.
But clearly not. Like, we see that in the result of the election.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned it at the start of this interview. I asked you ages ago, like a few months ago, 4 or 5 months, I said, oh, so who do you think is going to win the election? You're like adamant. You're like, no, Trump's going to take it. Trump's definitely, like, there was no doubt in your mind. Where did that come from? I mean, why was there no doubt? Why were you completely not surprised? You say it's like a grounding of history that this was always going to happen.
From my perspective, certainly. I mean, you know, a little bit of American history here. As you look at the American Civil War, you know, after that came to an end, there was a short, brief period called Reconstruction, where blacks in the freed black slaves or freed black people in the South were beginning to gain political office, you know, things of that nature. And what we saw after that was a white backlash, similar to the exact same things that we see in this election. Were white people feeling that these black people getting political power, gaining status, was a threat to them, gave them a sense that they were themselves losing power. And the response to that was the rise of the KKK and then 100 years of Jim Crow and mass lynchings, you know, that were unaccounted for. Similar today, though, right under Barack, you know, all these, everybody's seen the videos, the ubiquitous videos of black people being murdered, unarmed by the police. Police getting away with it.
Yeah.
Nobody being charged. Nobody's going to jail. I mean, that's the same things that were taking place with the lynchings in the South, right? So the writing's been on the wall for some time. This response is exactly the same response. And again, how could we expect anything different when the work hadn't been done?
Yeah. It's just, I think we'll talk about it a bit later, but this failure, I guess, of white liberals over in America to actually see that this is coming. That's a big part of it. That not understanding that American history and how that plays a part in where we are actually now. Just wanting to jump ahead,
yes.
And not actually looking back.
Yes, for sure. And I think the degree to which many of them are unaware of that history.
Yeah.
So wouldn't even know where to look back to.
Yeah, definitely. There was one voting group that voted overwhelmingly for Hillary. What was it?
Black women held it down. 93% of black women. I mean, I don't want to speak for black women, obviously, because I'm a black man. So I don't want to speak for them and speak out of turn. But I mean, it was a choice out of two really terrible candidates.
Yep.
And they went for the one that they, for lack of a better word, considered to be the lesser of two evils.
Yeah. And do you think that was, I mean, it's interesting. That's an overwhelming statistic, isn't it?
Right. And historically, black people, black women are Democratic voters, right? They vote for the Democrat Party. I mean, in a two-party system, that's your choice, right? You're going to vote Republican, you're going to vote Democrat. And I guess I don't believe the Democrats have done a good job at all of representing black people and black issues, and most blatantly represented by Barack Obama. And I think you wanted to get into that a little while later, and we can certainly talk about that. But again, like, I think maybe there's a sense that, you know, at least the Democrats are a little bit more accommodating.
Yeah.
At least that's the belief, right? They're a little bit more accommodating than the Republicans would be.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's the same here where a lot of black fellas are traditional Labor voters. I think
right.
It's slowly changing, but I guess we do have a third option now, sort of.
Yes.
But I think that's the same. I think you just traditionally vote for a very same party that's perceived to be for your interest.
They're perceived to be for your interest in a two-party system, certainly. So yeah, black people are traditionally Republican voters. I mean, obviously, black women overwhelmingly turned out for Hillary. Again, 93%. Black men, I think it was 80%.
Yeah.
But, you know, even when in local elections or even state elections in term for governors, regardless of the gender of the candidate, black people overwhelmingly, male and female, vote for the Democrat candidate.
It's interesting because I was reading a few analysis today, and people, and especially from the left, don't want to talk about this issue of race. They see it more as a class issue, particularly a white working class issue. There seems to be reluctance, or even just complete, no, this was definitely not about racism. This is about class and the working class. What would you say to that?
And like, we haven't done the work. This is an example of the work hasn't been done, and the failure of white liberals to have done the work.
Yeah.
Again, I think that white liberals took Barack's election twice in 2008 and 2012 as a means of having done the work. That casting the vote was doing the work. I would say it's a sanitized form of quote unquote race work that, you know, we are post-racial, that we've gotten over our racial issues because I went to the booth and voted for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
I don't know what the data is from the exit poll data for 2008 and 2012. However, what we do know is that Barack Obama won in 2008 and 2012 overwhelmingly because of the huge black voter turnout and people of color, and certainly white liberals. Some white liberals did vote for Barack Obama in both of those years, but they weren't the reason.
But they claimed credit for it.
But they took credit for it. Right? Yeah. They took credit for it. And that's another example then where just the work wasn't done, and that's why we're in the place that we are today.
So what do you think, I guess, the anti-Trump vote would have been, saying that you're voting against Trump? What was that a vote against, I guess, what they were thinking?
I think it was a vote really for their own interests. Like, at the end of the day, like, politics, in my opinion, really just boiled down to these ideological battles for white people due to their inherent privilege. Look, the reality of this election is, in as much as we see the tears of white liberals on TV after finding out that Trump won the election, the reality is that, if they're being honest, their life is relatively unchanged regardless of who won that election.
No,
if Trump won or whether Hillary won, their life is not going to see any relative change. So, in voting for Trump, they're voting for their own. Obviously, they're only voting for their own interests, or for Trump.
I mean, it's almost like a statement, isn't it? In the same way, maybe voting for Barack Obama was a statement. Voting against Trump.
Yeah, totally. The statement would be that obviously they're voting for party.
Yep.
They're voting for ideology, like that they're white liberals and they're on the other side of the ideological divide than the Republicans. And also, I would say there's a degree to which anti-Trumpism became the neoliberal brand for white liberals in the 21st century, in that voting or not voting for Trump or being anti-Trump implies that one is not racist.
Yeah.
Without having to do the work.
Yeah, and I think that segues into, I was watching an interview with John Pilger this morning on, I think it's called Going Underground, but it was on YouTube, but it's a TV show. And I think it segues into the media very well and why they missed this election victory from Trump.
But even elites that are part of that corruption surely need to know facts on the ground. Why the elites and all the media, which goes along with it, NBC, ABC, CNN, BBC over here, why would the journalists, why would the people themselves not want to know the facts and realize that Trump was going to win? Because you said you weren't surprised. Yet they seem surprised.
They're not journalists. They're anti-journalists. One of the most revealing aspects of this has been the exposure of journalism. The exposure of journalism as an extension of that same corrupt established power that I've been speaking about. They're not independent. They are echo chambers. They amplify and echo that which is handed down to them. Look, and the worst, of course, the greatest echoes are the so-called enlightened, respectable, liberal press.
So John Pilger was talking there about, I guess he was asked about why the media missed this, and he's talking about particularly the failure of the white liberal press. Do you see that? I guess it's very hard to find actually news of what's actually happening. Do you find that?
Yes, for sure. I mean, the failure of the media is because the media is overwhelmingly white.
They you don't can't argue with that.
They don't hire us, but if anybody's out there that wants to get a really good writer who has astute social critique, who called this election a year ago, my name's Joseph Boston. Hit me up. Amy's my agent. But but yeah, I mean, the media is white, and so we're only going to look at things from one particular perspective and the white racial frame of things, and they're only going to be able to provide us that myopic narrative.
Yeah,
they're not going to think too much outside the box, and again, heavily dependent on polls. A lot of different reasons why the media missed this.
It's interesting as well, because if it's white people who've basically voted in this way, they've missed their own story. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Well, I think, again, it speaks to the inability for them to even be honest about themselves. I think you just mentioned earlier about how even after the election, you're saying that the story that you've been seeing is that this is about class and not about race. But class and race intersect. And the reality is that around the world, black people, those who are considered to be black, indigenous people, we represent the bottom part of the class structure there because of systemic white supremacy. That keeps us from rising up through that system.
Yeah, it was really interesting what you're telling me about not even being part of the working class. So it's interesting where they're talking about a distinction between the white working class and, I guess, the minorities or working class, that even black people in America aren't actually even part of that working class you were telling me before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that shouldn't be confused to, like, black people don't work. Yeah. But there's not enough black people in the labor force for there to be a black working class. Again, like when the average black family in America makes $11,500 a year, four-person family, you're not in the working class.
No.
I mean, you look at the history of labor movements in the United States. The history of that has been the white working class working to keep the black people out, or people of color, out of the working class to maintain a system of white supremacy.
Exactly.
Where they themselves are the ones that have the access to the jobs. You know, that fear of race-based fear of competition, right? That they didn't want to have these black people also being considered inferior, competing for their jobs. So there's no such thing as a working class when it comes to black people.
Yeah. And I mean, when you talk about that, it's interesting because it's the history of Australia as well. Like, you even look at first after equal wages, after blackfellas actually got equal wages after being basically put in slave conditions.
Yep.
The whole point, you know, that alcohol was brought in and then welfare and everything is because they couldn't get jobs after that, because white people didn't want to give up their positions then. And the same thing with South Sea Islanders coming over here after they got equal pay, you know. Trade unions didn't advocate for any South Sea Islanders. You know what
That's
I mean?
Right.
It's continual. I mean, the colonial project's very much uniform all around the world.
And also we can add that any attempt to black people to organize and make their own unions – those white people came in and, white labor unions came in and worked to destroy those, even to the point where people were murdered. Black people were murdered to prevent them from having a voice within in the labor force, and to formulate any type of black working class. Again, this is another example of the way that whiteness has controlled, have control over the system to keep black people oppressed, keep black people at the bottom. Again, $11,500 is the average income for a four-person black family in the United States.
Right. But you look at the just mass incarceration, and I think it affects one in every three
black male
in America, which is huge. I mean, you just think of all the men who've, not employed through that, So it's not even a stretch to even believe that's true. I mean, it's obviously true. You know, a lot of black men are jailed.
Right.
Things they shouldn't be jailed for.
Right. And you think about the way, I mean, the prisons also became like a necessity in that regard, because you had all these black men running around who didn't have work.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so there's a lot of history there to unpack, so I'm not trying to be reductive there. There's a great documentary by Ava DuVernay on Netflix called The 13th.
That's what I was referring to. Yeah.
If you're interested in learning more about this topic in a very nuanced and summarized way. But ultimately, like, you look at after World War II. So during World War II, when all the white men were away fighting the war in Europe, black men eventually joined them too, and black women. But certainly at the beginning of the war, they weren't allowed to go to war, right? The crazy thing is black people actually advocated to be allowed to join the war and go fight for a country that didn't even see them as citizens, no less human beings. But that said, when the white labor force largely was over in Europe and other places in the world fighting the war, black people were working in the factories, you know, yeah, for the war machine, building tanks, so on and so forth. When white men came back, and that industry was gone, there was no jobs available to them. And as we move forward into a technological age, no jobs available. So basically you have a demographic of black people running around with no work to do.
So prisons they become super predators, do they? That's the easiest thing to do.
Super predators, and the prisons became a place to put them. And they work in prison too, right? The 13th explicates that very well, is that, you know, going to prison and working for these Fortune 500 companies at essentially slave labor became a way to put black people to work, quote
and
unquote.
They make a lot of money from it. I mean, you make a lot of money from that prison industrial complex.
Complex, totally. Yeah, I mean, these corporations in America are making millions, if not billions, of dollars off this slave labor that is now in mass incarceration. And that's what the 13th is about, by the way. The 13th is about the 13th Amendment. I think I talked about this before when I came on the show, before the documentary came out, that, you know, 13th Amendment enshrines slavery through prison in the U.S. Constitution.
And it's amazing how it's played out so perfectly for them in a way. You know, it just worked like, I don't know. they really figured it out well.
Yeah, well, again, I think you look at American history, I'm sure it's the same here in Australia, that nothing really changes. It just takes on another form.
Yeah.
And that really replicates what came before. It just looks a little differently. It might operate a little differently. So, you know, it's not slavery anymore. Now it's sharecropping. It's not sharecropping. Now it's, you know, prison industrial complex,
mass incarceration.
Just put new words in new systems.
I mean, it was interesting because, I mean, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, under his Crime Act, I mean, the rates of incarceration, crime bill went huge rates. And, you know, Hillary's well known for talking about super predators and that sort of rhetoric.
Yes,
so
totally.
You look back, I mean, even it would have been even scary if Hillary had won the election.
Yeah, totally.
For black people.
Yep. Now, I think real quick, the irony of Hillary also losing the election is, I think it's connected to that crime bill, right? And that, and the mass incarceration of black people. Again, the 13th does a great job explicating that. In that this large demographic of people, these disenfranchised people caught up in the quote unquote war on drugs, incarcerated, you know, on three strikes you're out for having, you know, small possession of grams of weed and automatically getting a sentence of 5 to 15 years. Then also being, when released, now that they're felons, not being allowed to vote and participate within the system. I think that's changed in some states. But think about how all those votes might have helped put her over the top. So it's almost a case of the chickens come home to roost for Hillary in many ways, that there's a large degree to which she was responsible for her own undoing.
Yeah. Do you think things would have changed under Hillary? I mean, obviously it's not a win-win situation at all.
Not at all. I think I definitely understand the preference, I guess, for a Hillary Clinton presidency over a Trump one. But I'm also of the opinion that had the Democrats won, had Hillary won, it would have falsely represented who America is today, right? I think that Hillary winning, much like Barack, would insidiously present this notion that we are, that America has progressed.
Yeah, right.
And that a Hillary Clinton win would have reified all the mythology of America, that it's a fair, equal, just country.
Yeah.
Trump very clearly shows us what America is. There is no having to parse the tea leaves. It very blatantly says that America is racist, that America is sexist, that white lives matter and yours don't.
Yeah. And they really represent the same thing, don't they?
They totally represent the same thing. But I think, again, like, the politics of the left are quite different, where in order to unpack the things that we see very transparently and very clear with the GOP and with Trump now as president and the result from this election, those things that are made very abundantly clear aren't so abundantly clear when you have a Democratic president, no less a black one or you know, a white woman who didn't make it. But yeah.
I mean, do you think the prospect of a Trump presidency will lead to greater movements or greater unity amongst the left or anything like that? Will it have an impact on
It's a little probably a little early to tell right now. I mean, I would hope though that the history of black progress in America has come from black people.
That's true.
Organizing, yeah. Resisting, taking matters into their own hands. Black people have never received anything from the government that we didn't fight for and die for ourselves. And so I think the work that needs to be done under Trump would be the same work that needs to be done under Hillary. I just think people would have been maybe placated into a level of comfort that they know that they clearly cannot be under a Trump presidency. Trump makes it very clear. The question is, what are we going to do to respond to that? Or what are they going to do to respond to that?
It's actually a real good distinction you make, because I mean, it's already happening with Black Lives Matter, as you said, like, because, you know, African-Americans are directly affected by this. They're going ahead and doing it, whereas white liberals, they are comforted by a lot of that, you know, the fluffy feelings they get from electing, for example, a woman president. You know, African-American people don't have that luxury.
Not at all. Not at all. And I think that's a great point, bringing up Black Lives Matter. Think about the necessity for a movement like Black Lives Matter that had to rise up under a black president.
Yeah, well, that says it all, doesn't
that
it?
That says it all. It says it all, right? That, you know, on his face, it should be that we shouldn't need a Black Lives Matter movement if we have a black president. But again, I think, again, that speaks to the insidiousness of left-wing politics and what it actually says to us, insidiously so, that we don't represent racism, that we don't represent sexism, so on and so forth. It's all very coded. And that's for the reason why that's why there is a Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, it's interesting. They do outsource. I mean, we were talking a bit about Trump. They outsource their own, you know, racism, sexism to a figure, to an individual, don't they? And that was Trump.
To an individual, to a party.
Yeah.
And most certainly so.
It'll be interesting to see if that continues, though, because Trump's going to be the president for...
Yeah, well, I think what we'll see with the Trump presidency is much what we saw with the Bush presidencies.
Yeah.
I think that was an irony for me is that, you know, certainly we can say that Trump, because of the environment that was created, this backlash to having a black president, Trump was able to be much more transparent and much more verbally vocal about his associations with white supremacists, you know, using white supremacist language very plainly. So
yeah,
he was able to do that because of that culture and that environment that he was coming into. So
it was already open to him. You know, there shouldn't be any shock that he was able to say those things, I guess.
Right. Totally. Totally. And again, the seeds were planted for that he was, remember, this was the man that was at the forefront of the birther movement, that was creating that question mark for white people around Barack Obama's authenticity. You know, he's not even American. He's a Muslim.
Yep. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, when you look back at the history just of the past, that people don't remember. People are so short-sighted, even
right.
from 3 years
right.
ago.
Right, so coming
they?
Back to what I was saying about George Bush is that you think about the language around Bush when in 2000,
yep.
when he quote-unquote stole the election, all the controversy with the uncounted ballots, the lots ballots, the voter suppression that took place in Florida in 2000, and then he won again in 2004, and people were saying much to what they were saying today, right? He's like, how is this happening? You know, and you think about that. How many people actually had anything positive to say about Bush during those times,
yeah,
right? Like, much of the language around him was the same language you hear about Trump. This guy's crazy. He's disqualified. He's the worst presidential candidate ever. How did America do this?
Yeah.
And then just as recently as like a month ago, we see Bush in a photo opportunity with the Obamas looking respectable.
Michelle Obama hugging him. He looked like an old grandpa.
Right. Looking respectable.
Yeah.
Looking affable. Meanwhile, the Asian continent, Afghanistan, Pakistan in shambles.
Well, we're dealing with the fallout of what he did.
Right. Iraq still devastated, but here he is in this photo opportunity with Michelle Obama, the lovable former president. So moving forward with Trump, I think we're going to see much of the same to a degree in terms of the mainstream. Like, there's much vitriol right now, but it'll be very similar to that of like what we saw with Bush.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I think I was talking to you was about that with Hillary, I guess everyone knows what would probably happen. There's a good, you know, people can sort of figure out what she would, how she would respond to things. I guess Trump, even though he's had the control of the media pretty much, he's been in the media spotlight this whole time.
Sure. Isn't that what he does? I mean, he had his own reality show for like 14 years.
Everyone went to him.
Yeah, for sure.
But at the same time, no one really knows what he's capable of, what he wants to do, anything. It's all based on his rhetoric.
Yeah, his rhetoric. Yeah. Which, again, I'm probably maybe a lone figure there. I thought Trump ran a very shrewd campaign. Don't mistake the word shrewd for me thinking it was an intelligent campaign or a smart campaign. But he ran the campaign he needed to win the election, right? Like, I've been saying that the whole time. He had his finger on the pulse of the temperature of America, right? He knew what makes America tick.
Mm.
You know, the race. So he played the race card that only white people can play. He played the sex gender card, you know, the sexism card. He played all of those things to great effect, and it worked.
I think it's interesting. He was very comfortable with the reality, wasn't he? Whereas other politicians try and cover it up with, you know, words like doublespeak, like justice and freedom and the greatest country in the world, blah, blah, blah. But he was very comfortable with the reality of what America actually is, maybe, which is why he could do it, play it so well.
Well, I think he knew that the people he was speaking to were very comfortable with the reality, that in as much as they invoke the words, this is truth, justice, and liberty for all.
Well, we know that's not true.
Right. As much as that is invoked, it's a lie, right? It's just this false veneer. The reality is what we saw in the post-election fallout, right? The reality is what we saw leading up to the election with the violence taking place at Trump rallies, you know. That's the reality.
Yeah.
And I think that he knew who he was speaking to. He knew that was their reality. And he knew that that was the best card he could play to win this election, and he won overwhelmingly. So he won the popular vote. I mean, last count I saw, he had won the popular vote. It was close. It was like two. I think it was a 2% difference, like 49%. The last time I checked, he had won, and Hillary had 47%. And then he overwhelmingly won the electoral vote that took him over the top. So who can? That's the reality, folks.
I mean, he's seen as the anti-establishment candidate. There was another, obviously, anti-establishment candidate in this election. It was Bernie Sanders. So a lot on the left are saying, oh, well, they should have picked Bernie. Do you think it would have ever changed if the Democrats had nominated Sanders?
No, Bernie had his own problems. Bernie was very problematic throughout the entire election. And just as of November 6th, he made two really significant tweets that I happened to catch. One was that Bernie Sanders, the supposed most radical candidate in the election, which, by the way, how is it that two white men are anti-establishment? How can you be more?
you're a white man. You have all the power.
Right. You can't be more establishment than a white man, right?
Like, interesting. You make a good point.
It's a joke, right? But Bernie had two tweets in particular, and in the last week, that one of them was that he reached out to Trump supporters and said that they need to be listened to. I'm just paraphrasing here. That they need to listen to, they need to be heard, and that we need to make an economy that works for them also, and not the few. We were talking about the white working class here, right? Again, keyword being working.
Yeah, I know, get what you're saying.
Right, keyword working, which is really, you know, Trump's base there.
Yeah.
Right. This is almost like a, if we want to include some Marxism here, we can make the argument that this is an equivalent of the proletariat's rising up against the bourgeois. White class warfare here, you know, and then they use black people as the buffer to prevent that actually taking place, right? That we get blamed for all the social ills of the country.
It does conveniently leave out the reality of black work.
Sorry, for sure. So the white working class is what he represents, and that's who he was speaking to.
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously seen that even though they do feel powerless, they're able to choose a president. They're able to get together and block vote to pull in the president
that
they want.
And by the way, when we talk about anti-establishment and being a white man is most, you are the establishment. You can't look at, again, the Trump is the representation of that. No other candidate could run a campaign the way that Trump won.
could Obama have said the things he said as a black man and get in?
Right. I mean, and to the degree, could even Hillary, right? Like, remember during the campaign, she said Trump supporters were the basket of deplorables.
Yeah.
And you would think that she said a lot, and you would think in that statement that she had said a lot of the stuff that Trump had said.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can't be more establishment than a white man, right? Yeah. There's no way Trump could be anti-establishment. That was another reason why I thought he was going to win, by the way, was you look at the way he ran the campaign in a way that nobody else could run that campaign, certainly not a black man or even
because of where he stood.
Yeah, and a white woman, and yet he still won. There became a point where it was like, after each journalistic outlet kept writing the story about Trump did this, you know, the sexual assault charges or allegations, the his statement about women and his racial statements, like this dude can't even take himself out the race.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was really confused actually about when everything was happening around his misogyny, because I just thought, how is this news to you?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I think you and I had a conversation about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's his brand, and that's been his brand for so long. Why would you, I mean, we know this. Why would you be
And certainly as much controversy was made about the statement about, you know, him grabbing women in their private areas, and the in particular the controversy and the outrage we saw from white women.
Yeah.
Didn't matter to them, did it?
No, I mean, obviously he's gotten this far on being like that already.
And ultimately,
so
again,
it's not going to change.
Right, and it did. And ultimately, it didn't matter to them that they weren't with her, they were with him.
As we said before, white women overwhelmingly, oh, well, not overwhelmingly, but they did come out to vote for Trump, so they did support
And I would
Trump.
Say overwhelmingly, like, at any point, if it's 50, over 50%, that's overwhelming. Like, if you went into your, black people go into the workplace today knowing that over 50% of their coworkers, white coworkers, voted for Trump. That's overwhelming right there.
I mean, what does that have, I guess, you're not over in America.
Right.
But I guess, what does it have for the psyche of so many African-American people, you know, to have a president like that? I mean, Hillary, I don't think is much different, but I mean, does it do anything, I guess?
I can't speak for, I don't want to position myself to speak for an entire group of people, but certainly we see from the fallout, even just on social media, people are justifiably, I think, to a degree, very fearful of what the future looks like, what the fallout of that will be. I mean, I can only speak for myself personally, though. I mean, again, like, we had to have a Black Lives Matter movement under a black president.
Mm.
They've been murdering us on the streets. We see that on the internet.
Oh,
we see that through
the plethora
of videos. So for me, what does that look like? How do I feel about that? I feel the same. Like,
yeah, it doesn't change. I guess it reiterates what you already knew.
Reiterates what I already knew. That black life is not valued. That black life is consistently targeted and in danger. I mean, just the other day here, right? Like in Maruka, that white man went on the bus and threw some gasoline on the bus driver.
Yep.
I think he was an Asian man somewhere from India or
Indian.
Yep. Threw some gasoline on him.
Yeah.
Right.
And he was mentally disturbed.
Right. So again, this is what I'm just bringing that up as an analogy to the very ubiquitous videos we see of black people being murdered in the street by the police.
Yeah,
like, so it doesn't really make much difference. And all that stuff is happening under Barack Obama. And I'm sure it will continue to happen under President-elect Trump.
Something that we started this with, the grab from Van Jones, talking about him waking up and being scared to tell his son. Like, he said something like, we tell our kids not to bully.
Yes.
So, you know, Trump is a bully, obviously.
Totally.
That's what we've seen.
Right.
I mean, even the fact that he can get away with that and become a president, you know, be voted in by the majority of as a president. But black people, I guess, have to tell their kids not to do this and not to do that. So there's a separate set of standards, isn't there?
Yeah, so I think in general we live in this society, though, right, where, you know, we have these quote-unquote set of kind of like standards and values of conduct that, you know, you don't speak unkindly to people, you don't bully people. And so I think people writ large – I hope people were large would, you know, tell their children these things as they're trying to raise their children to be good people and good citizens. But that said, the reality has been is that those things specifically pertain to children of color, black children. And the reality is, though, that even as we raise our children to not do those things, doesn't mean you're going to be accepted in society.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're going to get that job. But we can say it really, again, the privilege of whiteness is for white kids – doesn't really matter if you're a bully or not. Like, certainly it might matter in terms of your own sense of self, right? That, oh, I feel bad that I was really mean. In that regard, yes. But certainly when it comes to, like, becoming president of the United States of America, well, we see, right? Like, you can be a bully. You can be openly racist. You could be sexist, you know, and you could still get the top job in the land.
So really, you know, that
as an anti-establishment adage, white man.
Yeah. I mean, there's that old saying, like, anyone in America, you can, any kid can dream to be president. And that's what they said when Barack Obama became a president. But Barack Obama, maybe, do you think he's the exception? Because,
well, of course,
can anyone become president? Yeah, obviously, any white man maybe can.
Right, right. I think, yeah, I think Barack is totally the exception, of course. I mean, I think that when you look at Barack Obama, he is the peak expression of respectability politics, the peak expression. Everything that historically white people have said, hey, this is what you need to do in order to be accepted as one of us. He checks the boxes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, but yet he still wasn't accepted.
No, look at, I mean, Donald Trump and his birther movement.
Right,
you know?
He still wasn't accepted.
They had to come up with this big conspiracy theory because I couldn't find anything else.
100%, right? His record, didn't have any scandals. His record was completely unblemished, right?
Yeah.
To the degree to which even a Washington insider like Hillary couldn't beat him out for the nomination, the party nomination in 2008.
Yeah.
Unblemished. So he ticked all the boxes. I think he was a once-in-a-generational candidate, and yet white people overwhelmingly still rejected him. So what does that say about for the rest of us?
Yeah.
Right? That if they won't even accept Barack Obama, as stellar as he was, and not just as stellar as he was in terms of his resume, but in terms of his actions as president, as the first quote-unquote black president, who himself, by the way, said, I'm not the first black president. I'm not the black president of America. I'm the president of America, you know?
Yeah, he was very careful to distinguish himself, I guess.
Yeah, totally. So even when you look at his resume in terms of what he did as the president, his deep commitment to the maintenance of white American power and imperialism, rescuing the economy, right, bailing out the banks, Wall Street, white income up, you know, for, you know, going up, right? Last thing I checked, I think it was last week, that another 161,000 jobs added to the economy. Obviously, those numbers are fudged, but yet that's, you know what I'm saying? That's the numbers they presented. He's leaving the country in a better state. Killed Osama bin Laden, the boogeyman.
He right? did the job for him, didn't he?
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, and still,
they
rejected him.
Yeah.
So what does that say about somebody like myself who doesn't have that resume? Or somebody like yourself, or the millions of other black people who, you know, don't meet that standard. If they don't accept Barack, they're never going to accept us.
Yeah, so you think that will never happen again, that we'll never see?
I think the interesting question now at the end of all of this long election run here has been like, what, you know, and as Barack and his family begin to exit the White House and the office, is what's his legacy? And that's yet to be told, yet to be confirmed. But one thing we see very clearly is that Hillary didn't really, I feel like Hillary didn't lose to Trump so much as she lost to Barack again. So she lost to Barack in 08. Stellar record, right? She just couldn't, and I think I think also too wasn't just his record. Like, I think the country was ripe for that change after coming off the 2 years of Bush, right?
Yeah.
You think about, again, you go back, people who got short-term memories.
Yeah, people changed.
Yeah, people got short-term memories.
But Barack Obama changed. It was,
yeah, his
was
whole
his
campaign was hope and change, right? That actual campaign in 08 won the industry equivalent of the Oscar in the marketing field for the hope and change campaign. So I think also coming off the back of like 2 terms of the Bush administration, you know, people feeling like they were misled into the Iraq War. That's an old different conversation within itself. Afghanistan, people were really, I think, feeling like they were ripe for that hope and change. So Barack came at the right time. So Hillary lost the nomination to him in 2008, and then she lost this election. But I think Barack's legacy is on this election, that long shadow of Obama.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Was on the, and we
well,
see
between
that.
Between Bush and Trump, he's going to be viewed very favorably, I can imagine, by history.
Who?
Barack Obama.
Well, history's
being mentioned between the two.
History's written by the victors, though. Like,
yeah. Well, that's true.
You know what I mean? And again, we see the vitriol around him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know what his favorability rating is right now, but we see the vitriol around him. We see, at least from white people's perspective, and we see the response, white people overwhelmingly voting for the Republican candidate, Trump. I feel like Hillary lost this election, not so much because Trump beat her, but because of Barack's shadow.
Right. People were ready for another change to go in another
direction. Well, yes, of course. This is that white lives matter backlash, that the response we see in these election results are white people saying that we feel like after 2-term black president, with all of the focus in the media on Black Lives Matter, that we are losing control, we're losing power, and this is their way of resetting things back to, quote unquote, the way they're supposed to be, or as Trump said, making America great again. And what making America great again is having a white man as president. Because remember, Barack Obama's the anomaly, right? He's the only difference that we've had in the 200 plus years of America, that he's the only anomaly. He was the only one that was anything different. Everybody else has been a white man. And so this is the response to that, like getting that white man back in power, regardless of his qualifications, regardless of his level of capability, regardless of his level of intelligence, doesn't matter. Just needs to be white, male, and breathing.
Yeah, and obviously we've seen that.
and this is where we're at.
Yeah,
so, yeah, so I think she lost because of his legacy. And I think that Barack Obama's legacy will be that it will affect American politics for the next 50 years, maybe even 100 years. I don't think we'll see a black president another 100 years, personally, because again, like, Barack was perfect. Barack was so perfect to the degree to which his mom was a white American woman and his dad was African. Like, he literally was an African American.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The first black man to be president of the Harvard Law Review, went to Ivy League school, went to Harvard, went to Columbia, was an organizer in Chicago. You know what I'm saying? Like, check,
talker, really
eloquent.
You know, could even dance on the Ellen Show, you know?
check, right? Yeah. So, you know, Barack wouldn't have won the election in 2008, no less even been nominated if his name was Tyrone and he was from, you know, Compton.
Yep. Yeah.
So he was perfect in that regard. So, yeah. Maybe 100 years. I could be off, obviously. I'm just prognosticating here. But 50 to 100 years. But I think at least for the next, say, 10 or 20 years, the Barack Obama presidency will dictate American politics.
It's really interesting. It reminds me, I was listening to an interview with NASA's first African-American head. So I think that he's still the first black administrator.
Okay.
And they said, oh, congratulations for the first African-American head of NASA. And he said, straight away, he said, no, it's not never the achievement to be the first. It's always better to be the second, because that means that it's not the exception.
Right.
The second one's actually more of something to celebrate, you know, because it means that there can be someone that comes after. It's not just about the individual.
Yeah, for
sure. I always thought that was so on point, and I'd never thought about it that way.
For sure.
Actually.
And you think about the pressures of the individual, like being the first, that as a black person, you kind of have this understanding that how this goes for me will determine if this organization hires any more black people ever.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
so you're
white
performing
people,
for your whole race.
Okay. Right, you have that pressure, right? White people don't have that pressure. Like, they just go get a job. It's just about me. It's just my job. Like, there's no concept, or it's, again, another aspect of white privileges is, like, there's no concept of if I don't do well, they're not going to hire any more white people.
Yeah.
But that is the reality. And so I feel like, when the reality is that we won't see another black president for, like, another 50 years.
Oh, yeah, I think you're totally true. Because where else would they – I can't even think.
Right.
I can't think of who they would – get, you know what I mean?
For sure. And I would like to add also real quick that there's another aspect of the story. I actually see it popping up. Another thing that really confirmed to me that Trump was going to win this was, like, Brexit.
Right, yeah.
Like, when Brexit happened in the UK, I was like, yeah, it's a wrap, right? This is a done deal. Like, Trump's going to win this election.
Why is that?
Well, again, I think another aspect of the story is also not just about a white American backlash to this false sense of a loss of power because of the first two-term black president. I think we see there's been a global right-wing swing taking place around the world. You know, we've seen it happening in Scandinavia. Obviously, we see it just most notably with England, with Brexit. United States was kind of, for lack of a better word, immune to that to a degree because they had already had entrenched, like, this the first black president, right? He'd already had the two terms in place as this movement started taking place. It's come back full circle now, though. When the opportunity was given to now elect a new leader, we see it happen. It's happened here, right? We got a right-wing conservative. We got a right-wing conservative government who I can't keep track of the elections
Labor
here. But
and Liberal are both just right-wing. Like,
most certainly, yes. Yeah. Like, yeah, the left is definitely more center-right than they are actually left, of course. But it just in terms of, like, the party that does represent that politic very clearly. What has it been, like, the last two or three elections? I can't keep up. This country has consistently decided to vote for a right-wing government. So we see that happen in England. We see it happening across Scandinavia. We've seen in Italy, there's just a right-wing swing taking place around the world. Why? Because of the blowback of white supremacy, the white imperialism, colonialism, you know, uncertainty about the economy, you know, the war on terror, the fear of terrorists, jobs. This, all of these things have caused white states around the world to double down, right? To go into this kind of protection mode for themselves.
It's very interesting because when you think about it, minorities, you know, black people, Aboriginal people over here have had generations of poverty, and yet the one time, you know, the working class in America is obviously in trouble, they can rise up and change a government.
And I would say falsely in trouble again. I mean, I think if trouble – this is the same argument that I think this was at the heart of the Sanders movement that I was talking to you about earlier that I was critiquing the entire time, is that basically the white millennials' argument is that we don't have access to the plunders of white supremacy in the same way that our forebears did. That's the issue, right?
Yeah.
Is that I've got a college degree, but I can get a job, but I just can't get a job as quickly as like – I used to be able to get a job, or even the way my parents used to be able to get a job. I'm living a home with my parents, itself within a privilege, can't afford to buy a home. All of these entitlements, the right to a college degree, the right to a home, are all entitlements that they speak on as if they have been accessible to everyone.
When the reality
is the furthest thing from the truth, right? Like that these things have always been entitlements specifically for white people, the right to an education, the right to a home. And so that's the core, that's the crux of the argument there, whether it's from the millennials. This is actually where the millennials and like the Republican base, Trump's base, which was formerly the Tea Party, moved into a mainstream, quote unquote, anti-establishment, quote unquote, politicized movement that propelled them to the win. This is the commonality of the two, that both of these bases, just one being on the left, the other one being on the right, are saying we don't feel heard. We have a sense of a loss of powerlessness. You know, the jobs are hard, can't get jobs anymore, or jobs are harder to find. This is the common thread between them both. And yet this false white angst in that regard was able to form a political movement in terms of Sanders, and it was able to form a political movement in terms of Donald Trump.
Yeah, right.
That got him to the president of the United States of America.
So that's actually a lot of power, isn't it?
Huge amount of power.
For people who feel powerless.
Totally. Remember, like, even though Barack became president, it wasn't like Barack became president due to the angst of black people, or that somehow the black angst was able to coalesce into a movement that produced a candidate for black people that then became president of the United States of America. That's not the way it went down. Remember in 08, Barack came out of nowhere. Who was this guy, Barack Obama? And at the beginning of 08, everybody was for sure thought Hillary was going to win, just like they thought Hillary was going to win in 2016. And then Barack came out of nowhere. You know what I mean? Same situation, right? So so the white working class, in as much as they claim to be oppressed, have so much power that they're able to form around a candidate who becomes president of the United States of America.
Joseph Austin, thanks so much for being on this show.
You're welcome.
Dropped so many truth bombs.
Thank you for having me. I'd love to come back.
That was Amy McGuire with Let's Talk.